If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Tell me, Julie, how do you stir up your creativity? You've got a lot of creativity in that that Melanie ears. How do you get it going?
Wow. You know what? I usually look at certain books that I think are intriguing, or sometimes I just sit down and write and just try to empty out all the goo.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about yourself?
You know, it depends on the task, I guess, but I find music tends to help. Put on some sort of music that seems fitting to, you know, if it's a particular writing assignment or project, you know, like what kind of music would stir me and get me into this?
Yeah.
A little coffee doesn't help. I mean, doesn't hurt. I mean, coffee doesn't help. A small amount of coffee certainly helps. Yeah, it's sort of setting the mood. And then, of course, inspiration from other things. If there's, you know, looking at writing that I really like.
Yeah.
Looking at art that I really like, and just, you know, becoming inspired and sort of mishmashing ideas together.
Yeah, I will say that sometimes I'll dance around too, which is a horrible admission, but I will I'll do like kind of 80s moves around the furniture and like high kicks and
like,
you think I'm kidding?
I'm just imagining you doing like kung fu in your living room or something.
Yeah.
to get like stoked up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't know, there's something about movement that's really freeing. And I think that kind of goes back to that whole thing about music and they're inherently being that part of your brain that wants to move.
Right.
Huh. Get things going. Anyway, yeah, these are the ways that you know, we kind of throw out the marbles of creativity and have fun.
Yeah. And creativity is one of those things. Everybody wants a slice of this pie. If you've got a slice of this pie, you want a bigger slice. Like, nobody, I've never heard anybody say, man, I'm just too creative. I wish I was just a little less creative.
Right.
And maybe everybody's like, oh man, I wish I could, even if you don't have writer's block, or you're not having trouble coming up with ideas, everybody could use a little bit more. And also everybody's been trying to understand it. Besides the fact that you could potentially market something to improve creativity, it's just one of the big questions about, who we are. We're a creative species. So
right.
What's at the bottom of that, right?
Yeah. So what is the science behind creativity, if you can even look at it that way? Which, thanks to fMRI, once again, we have a way that we can start to measure these things.
Yeah.
So it's not just, certain disciplines that are able to, expound on the greatness of creativity and how we can go after it. We can we can look at the muse if we want, but then we can also look at fMRI and say, okay, what's actually driving us in this process?
There are a number of different views on it that have come out over the years that don't involve fMRIs that I find interesting. Some of these I think we can sort of, we'll just sort of judge these as we go through.
All right. I will turn on my judging mind.
Turn on the judging mind. We'll discuss it more later. But first there's the cognitive view. And this is kind of like the basic idea here is that like even a computer, if properly programmed, could get really creative.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of, data A plus data B, I will combine into novel or mashup track, that kind of thing.
I just want to note that you're doing robot hands right now, just so people can get the full effect.
Well, we did them in yoga last night, so I got all into robot hands.
Wow. Yeah. Robo yoga.
Yeah. Is it the one where you lay down on the floor and you make robot hands?
No.
Maybe you guys don't do that
one. No. Sorry. Mine are less robotic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. More touchy-feely.
Okay, so that's one of them. Then there's the psychoanalytic Freudian view. And this one I don't really like because this one says that creativity is an occurrence of the subconscious. All right, well, that's fine. But it also gets into the idea that humans attempt to avoid pain through the creation of daydreams and dreams and fantasies. And if you follow this theory, it's like every like cool creative thing that has ever been is us trying to avoid pain. Which
is a reaction to like a depressive circumstance.
Yeah, and just sort of like, I got to get my mind out of this world and this life. I'm going to, it's just, which holds up with, I think the thing is a lot of these examples, like they can hold up under certain types of creativity.
Yeah.
And you could say, all right, well, this is an example of somebody trying to escape some hard circumstances and maybe they're doing a little bit of dreaming to get out of this world.
Right.
But then like, how do you explain somebody like Bobby McFerrin? Bobby McFerrin's happy. McFerrin's creative. Bobby McFerrin couldn't exist under this, view.
He doesn't need to escape his reality. He creates his reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's a happy man.
Yeah.
So I think I have problems with this.
No, I see that because it's limiting.
Yeah. Then there's the behavioralist view. And this one states that creativity is a combination of previously known knowledge joined together with a lot of spontaneity.
Okay.
All right. And it's also, it's about conditioned response to situations. Now, this one I kind of like. It's kind of like strikes me as kind of like the mashup approach, where it's like, I'm looking at this, I'm looking at this. They come together, new combinations or new ideas. And, kind of falling into stuff we've talked about in the Dream Inspiration, the Dream Inception podcast. We're talking about the brain kind of does this, where it sort of throws things together, different combinations, and an insight can sort of emerge from this.
Okay. Because when you say behavioralist, I always think about B.F. Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start thinking about Pavlov's dog.
Yeah.
And could Pavlov's dog have been creative?
I guess that's the downside to it because it does make it a situation where this is conditioned response to a situation.
Right.
So, B.F. Skinner is kind of a killjoy to everything. Drag him into
it. I know. I'm sure the dog was creative. Probably did get creative time after time after time that the bell was rung and it started salivating.
Then there's the another one is the intrinsic motivational view, and this is the idea that people reach their creative potential through the desire for pleasure in the activities that they engage in. And of course, the major criticism on this is that not all creativity or inventive enterprise comes out of an enjoyment of an activity. Now, I would argue that it helps if
right.
you enjoy it. I mean, I'm having a hard time thinking of an example where somebody did something really creative and awesome and hated every minute of it.
No, and I know I've said this like probably a million times in the previous podcast, but it's that whole obsessive quality to it that the mind plays with what it loves, essentially, right? So that's perhaps why we dream about certain things, or we just keep sort of rotating a certain problem around in our mind, because we want to find the solution.
Yeah, to take a totally non-scientific slant on it. It's kind of like the whole you can taste the love thing about food, Like this meal was prepared by somebody who was really into it. You can taste the love. And this meal was made in a factory and there's, love is not on the list of crazy, long-winded ingredients.
Hydrogenated peanut oil. Love.
Yeah. High fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
So I think there's a sense of that in a lot of things. It's like if someone doesn't care about it, if they're not passionate about it, they're mm-hmm. not obsessed at least on some level with it. If the brain's not, like you say, playing with what it loves, then you can generally tell because it's going to be crap.
Yeah. And I'm also thinking too about coffee since you've already mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
And that great TED talk that you sent me.
Oh, yes, yes. About, where does creativity come from?
Yeah. Coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The coffee. Because the argument there was that before coffee really integrated European society, people weren't drinking water because that stuff will make you sick.
Right.
So what do you drink all day?
Alcohol.
Exactly.
All day long.
Morning to night. Just a complete stupor for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is Stephen Johnson, right? He's a writer and a founder of Feed Magazine.
Oh, cool.
And he was talking about that. He was saying, like, look, here you have a depressant, mm-hmm. alcohol for all of this time, you know, up until like the 1600s, and then boom, coffee houses.
Yeah.
You not only have the stimulant, but you also have the culture.
And the interaction.
The interaction, yeah. the flow of ideas, and all of a sudden the Age of Enlightenment is starting to percolate in the UK, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Elsewhere, it's still fermenting, right?
Yes.
Oh, that's too far. Too far.
Nice.
That wasn't very creative.
I don't know. I like that.
Well, let's get into one more view, take on this before we get into the more scientific stuff, and that is the developmental view.
Okay.
And this one's another one I really don't like, because this one sounds like, this hard-faced father that doesn't want his child to write poetry, but wants him to play for the football team, kind of a thing.
Okay.
Because it's, in general.
Or Tiger Mom.
Right. Yeah.
Amy
Tiger
Chua.
Mom.
Yeah.
Well, at least she's, making them play the piano or
that's
star
true. The
on
violin
the front porch,
is,
right?
is a very creative instrument.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So this one maintains that the majority of creative behavior exists in younger life, and it's these younger developmental years that stir us to become creative.
Okay.
And then as we grow out of that, we grow out of such foolish ideas as creating things that are beautiful.
Oh.
Yeah, and we get down to the hard science of but see, that's the other thing. Something inside us dies. We get older, and I think this is one of those that you can sort of. I don't agree with it, but if you hold it up, you can say, oh, well, look, this artist, they sure did run out of good ideas as they got older. But then you see so many people who are just contrary to the rule. Like one of my favorite authors is this guy, Brian McNaughton. And it wasn't until the end of his life that he wrote like this really awesome collection of short stories called Throne of Bones. And it was like the last thing he really wrote. And then he kind of trickled off and died. But he wrote that like well into his, like into his 50s, I think. So
I was actually looking at some research on peak years, depending on different disciplines. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that writers actually peak after their 40s, generally. Huh. And that poets, like 20s.
Huh.
And then it's over.
Wow.
I know. It's very odd. But I wonder if it kind of goes back to that idea that there's something intrinsic to the way that you are looking at the world when everything is fresh and new.
Yeah. Or maybe the writers somehow avoid getting a real job until their mid-40s and the poets are able to find gainful employment.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. They didn't really widen the circumstances of the studies they were looking at to include that information. So it's very possible. But, when I think about creativity, I always think about the right brain.
Oh, yes.
I have to say, I was one of those people who thought, oh, okay, this is, I'm a right brain person or I'm a left brain person. And that seems to be something that is completely inaccurate that came out of some sort of 70s notion of personality tests.
Yeah, but people loved it because it has this sort of star-bellied Sneetches kind of a thing to it where
yeah.
it's a war between the creatives and the non-creatives. It's the left brain versus the right brain.
Right.
And this idea of an internal struggle, too.
Yeah, but in fact, it's actually a lot more nuanced than that.
Yeah.
And there's a conclusion from one study by surgeon and jazz musician Charles Lim,
mm-hmm.
who we'll now refer to as the jazz doctor.
Oh, yeah.
The jazz doctor. And that is that there is no single creative area of the brain. So there's no focal activation of a single area, which is really important.
Yeah. You got a whole lot of stuff going on there. And it's not like you can say, look, there's the creativity right there. It's
right.
You look at these fMRIs of people engaging in creative activities, and it's throughout the brain. It's not like, just one little portion lighting up.
Yeah. And when they were looking at some of these activities, too, a lot of them were music based ones. And we mm-hmm. saw this when we were doing research for music and the brain.
Uh-huh.
Same thing. Like the entire head is or the entire brain is lighting up like a pinball machine. So that's the interesting part about this. You've got language, you've got the seat of judgment, so on and so forth.
Yeah. I was really impressed with this one in that they had like a special keyboard created that could basically go inside the fMRI.
Yeah.
Which again, the fMRI, have you ever seen, you know, people going into a giant, you know, big square device with a little hole in it, and they, you know, they put them in, and they have, you have to be real still. Like, that's the fMRI.
Yeah.
And so they had to create this little keyboard that they could, the jazz musicians could do a little improv piano playing on,
yeah,
while they were in it. So, and they had to create it so that it had like, you know, minimal interference with the fMRI, and it sent like a MIDI signal to a computer.
Yes.
And then that was
so they could hear it back. Yeah. Yeah. Which is, yeah, so incredible. Of course, the jazz doctor would do that, right?
Yeah.
And again, that's Charles Lim. He's looking at these MRI scans of jazz musicians and rappers.
Freestyle rappers. That part was really amazing too, where he's getting like, he's looking like it with a number of Baltimore area hip hop artists.
Yeah.
And like getting them in, throwing them in the fMRI and just getting them freestyling.
Yeah. And this is the cool thing. This is how he, created this study, is with the jazz musicians. He had them learn a piece of music that he wrote that was only familiar to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asked them to play it back, and they scanned their brains. And then he asked them, okay, can you improvise on this? They looked at the improvisation and the brain scanning at the same time. Same thing with the rappers. They had the rappers rap something that the jazz doctor wrote, which is pretty fun. It's actually pretty good for like a non-rapper.
Well,
says me, who has no experience in the rap world.
It's adorable, but I don't know if it is good.
Actually. Okay, you're right. It's adorable rapping. And then there are certain words that are highlighted in this prepared rap that Dr. Jazz says, okay, now rapper, can you take those at certain cues, take those words, and now you start to freestyle. Mm-hmm. You start to improvise on this. And what's really interesting is they found that there are a couple parts of the brain that went really quiet during the improvisation. And this is the brain's dorsal, lateral, prefrontal, and lateral orbital regions. Okay. So you know. Just for the record.
Okay, I'm touching that part of my head
now.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. And that's the seat of judgment. So what that was telling us is that in order to improvise, to reach what I think is sort of like an apex of creativity, right? Because mm-hmm. if you're just free-forming anything, then you're really relying on not just your own past experiences, but you're really playing with form. And so that part that's like, oh, you're no good. Oh, stop doing that.
Yeah.
Which is called the observer effect, actually, in writing.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. That part goes quiet. So we know that in order to reach that sort of state, you have to be able to get in some sort of flow.
Okay. So this is the flow moment. This is like when you're writing and suddenly you don't even realize that the music has stopped playing and you're just going.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then what they saw is that the medial prefrontal cortex was going nuts. And they also, and that allows self-expression, by the way. So, you know, there's actual hard data here, as much as it can be with fMRI, that points to at least this one part of it. We know that we have to be in this sort of frame of mind.
Huh.
Which is
and it actually falls in line with if anybody out there has ever taken an improv class.
Yeah.
You know, that as I recall from like acting classes back in college, you know, they're always like, you know, don't bring your judgment into it. Just go with it. Just, you know, don't worry about looking like a fool. Because that's gonna get in the way of doing something.
Which, you know? Like, for 99.9% of the population is really hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the same. I mean, anytime you create something, you're going out on a limb and you gotta be on one level, you gotta be confident in what you're doing, but also just kind of like, yeah, some people may not dig it and we're gonna roll with that. I do that every time I get behind this microphone, I guess.
Me too. But yeah, I mean, you have to have the passion for it too, right?
Yeah.
So that's where that comes into play. You want to be able to have fun with it and hang out with whatever format you are using, whether or not it's podcasting or whether or not it's scientific research or astrophysicists, all of that creativity comes into play.
Well, that's something that also is important to stress about, like the whole idea of like, where does creativity come from? There's also this kind of false dichotomy between like artistic creativity and scientific creativity.
Yeah, it's sort of been like gangs, you know, like East Side, West Side in the past, because they never thought that the two would meet. But since we're learning so much more about how creativity works, we realize that it's across the board.
Yeah.
And in fact, and that actually makes me think about that Steven Johnson TED video, because he talks about that sort of improv that happens. And he used the example of when Sputnik was launched and how there were some astrophysicists hanging around and mm-hmm. someone was like, hey, can you guys figure out the trajectory of that? Can you do those frontwards and backwards? And they just as a, you know, okay, we'll just sit down and do this for 8 hours sort of thing. Uh-huh. We're playing with that data, which led to what we now know as GPS, right?
Yeah.
Which is so cool.
That's incredible.
It's not even something they set out to do. It's just sort of a game for them. Another thing that I wanted to talk about too, in terms of myths is that there's this lone creative genius idea. So again, talking about these astrophysicists who got together on this problem. You know, that flies in the face of what we always think of as this person, you know, toiling away at whatever they're doing and having that eureka moment when in fact we know that it really takes a village, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that usually, and of course it can be a solitary endeavor, but it's not usually something that just happens out of the blue. It's usually, something that someone's been working on for a really long time. And it's almost like, in terms of groups, sort of like emergence that we talked about in that podcast where everybody is pooling their intelligence and that's creating all of this, really interesting, innovative ways to look at a problem and to tackle it.
Yeah.
And I was even thinking about someone like the artist Damien Hirst, who's done like the huge puppy dog sculpture.
Ooh, I don't think I've seen that.
Yeah. It's amazing. I want to say it's like 100 feet high and, he's done different versions of them and, you know, it's a highly polished veneer. It looks like metal and it reflects back the person looking at it. And for some reason, it's really mesmerizing. It's very cool. Anyway, he's done a lot of this sort of, pop art, I suppose you could call it. But the fact of the matter is that this guy has a huge team of artists working under him mm-hmm. who feed him ideas, who come up with color samples. And so it's not like just Damien Hirst sitting there being a genius.
So it's kind of like the Mr. Brainwash.
Yeah. From the documentary, Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, he's relying on a lot of different people to get together on these ideas. And of course he's, you know, I guess you could say that he's the person who's directing the project, mm-hmm. but without all of those people under him, there's no way that he could pull off the sort of art that he does.
It's like the George Lucas factor. You know, it's like when you look at the creation of the original Star Wars movies, it's like, yeah, Lucas had like this idea, but then he's like, all right, guys, design me this, design me that. And, you know, so I kind of think of like Mr. Brainwash and George Lucas in the same area.
Yeah, no, it may have been him who looked at a bridge and then said, oh, the way that bridge is constructed, how can I fit that into this worldview that I'm creating?
Yeah.
Which is really interesting, but you're right. It takes a fleet of people to pull that off.
Starfleet, it's Star Trek. Sorry.
I know.
Oh man, that was almost a huge nerd faux pas there.
Huge.
Yeah, and it gets into the idea of collective intelligence, mm-hmm. you know, that it's, you know, it's about interaction between individuals. And, and I actually ran across this great quote from, Wall Street Journal's Matt Ridley. His whole thing was that like, there's hope for the future because, quote, ideas are having sex with each other as never before, you know, and, because the idea is that like modern innovation doesn't depend on a single human brain to contain it.
Yeah.
Because you have all these people working on things. And then it's like everybody is like has the, like I sometimes when I think of creativity, I think of it like the maple syrup spigot that you put in the tree, except mm-hmm. it's stuck in the side of your head. Like everybody can squeeze out a cup each day. But through like modern science and modern culture, everybody is taking that little cup of syrup and they're pouring it into the collective ocean of syrup that we continue to pull from.
Then it's just our job to wade through the syrup and figure out what it is that we need from syrup the syrup.
Waders. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, presents its own problem, right?
Yeah. We get into the whole idea of, you know, web 3.0 and the semantic web where the web, the syrup ocean will wade through itself, at our slightest command. It gets pretty deep.
It gets pretty sticky.
Yeah. Sticky.
I don't know what's going on here. There's a lot of punning going on. Well, that makes me think of dopamine, of course.
Yes, this is the good stuff, if you will. Right?
Yeah, the syrupy stuff. There's a sort of dopamine factor, if you will. And researchers were studying receptors in the brain, and they found at the Karolinska Institutet that there's a dopamine system in healthy, highly creative people that's similar to some people with schizophrenia.
Okay.
So it's almost like this dopamine gene. Actually, it's not almost, it is. They have found actually that the dopamine receptors are linked to the ability for divergent thought, which is really necessary in creative thinking or innovative thinking. The study measured the creativity of the healthy individuals using psychological tests. And then the task was to find as many solutions to a problem as possible. And so they found that highly creative people, they're calling them healthy people because they don't have schizophrenia, and schizophrenic people have a low density of dopamine receptors. And what this means is that the dopamine receptors in the thalamus, which is linked to the sensory information that gets passed on to the cerebral cortex, means that there's a lower degree of signal filtering. Hmm. And so there's a higher flow of information from the thalamus, which really means that, like, what might get sort of plugged up before all these ideas are actually coming through at an incredible rate is what I'm thinking, is that you're just getting bombarded by all these different ideas, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
So that sort of accounts for some of the more bizarre symptoms that you see in schizophrenia. But in a healthy person, that accounts for their ability to make creative associations pretty easily.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if this guy had schizophrenia, but there was this guy on the train a couple of weeks ago.
Already, just, you say the train. Yeah.
And it was just amazing stuff. I mean, he seemed, I can enjoy it because he seemed very happy. He was not a, like, you know, he did not seem to be in misery.
Yeah.
But he was like sort of giving this, he was preaching this kind of Afrofuturist message. And it had to do with like the face on Mars and the Kennedy assassination and like.
Okay. There's already another red flag Kennedy assassination. Okay. Go on.
Oh, no. Elvis showed up in it and there was a whole thing.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. I actually recorded it, and I have it kicking around here somewhere, but,
oh God, you've got to, please, we've got to put that on Facebook in some way. If I don't know if we can do audio files.
Well, we can. I just, I guess I'll have to check and see if this one's kosher. Cause it also right. gets into like the idea that the sun is racist and has a brain. So
it could be.
It could be. I don't know.
I don't know.
But, man was asking questions. There was a lot of interesting data, but it was like, it was so like crazy creative that it was like, that's why I recorded it, you know, cause like, this is amazing. I love this.
Well, and obviously this is someone whose judgment part of the brain was completely shut off.
Yeah. Cause he's, most of us, even if we had these thoughts, we wouldn't just spout them to an entire train full of people.
No. Yeah. I don't normally, at least. But that points to that whole madness aspect too, right?
Yeah. Do you have to be crazy? Do you have to be deeply troubled to be creative?
Right. Yeah. Which is again, another stereotype that we have about creativity. But I thought it was interesting. I found this, Van Gogh, couple other folks, Edgar Allan Poe, Lewis Carroll, according to Eve LaPlante, who has a book called Seized, that these were people who, suffered from temporal lobe seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could very well be that a lot of the art that they produced books and so on and so forth were a result of that sort of hallucinatory period, in which they were seeing things afresh. And if you look at Van Gogh's work, you can really see that, right? Because it's sort of like he hears the Starry Night one, right? Which is the archetypical, Van Gogh painting, and you recognize it, but it looks like the world has tilted about 30 degrees and everything is so much brighter and fresher looking, like these incredible, you know, colors popping out. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so intriguing about it, is because it captures something that's familiar, but at the same time, completely alien.
Huh.
So there you go. I mean, there is something that we have intrinsically thought mad about, you know, Van Gogh and his paintings. But again, this is very likely just a side effect of his own temporal lobe seizures.
Hmm. Now, of course, it's, you know, important to point out that not everybody who is intensely creative is crazy or has some sort of problem. But we often fall back on that, I find.
Well, like, that's what I was sort of saying, is that, you know, people sort of point to that and say, oh, well, they're just mad. We know so much more now, medically, scientifically, about conditions that we can say, well, you know, this unique perspective was brought on by that. But, you know, some people say that you could get that same perspective from transcendental meditation. You know?
Oh, yeah. The director,
David Lynch,
right?
Yeah. 36 years strong doing that.
Wow.
Every morning, every night.
And he's completely normal. I mean,
he's totally normal. And his films make perfect sense.
They do. Well, yeah, Dune makes pretty
Yeah. Actually, there's an essay by David Foster Wallace about Dune.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
It's fascinating.
I have to read that. Then.
You do. It basically says, like, that's the reason why David Lynch can do what he can is because he took this one mainstream job. But what I thought was interesting is David Lynch was talking about his meditating experience, and he says, it's so beautiful how the enjoyment of beauty blossoms when the suffocating rubber clown suit of negativity begins to dissolve.
Well, I have,
which is so Lynchian.
Yeah, but I mean, I kind of like just last night when I was having to like I got off work, went to yoga, and then after yoga, I came home, had dinner, and then worked on this podcast a little more.
Yeah,
and there's a meditative aspect to yoga, and it kind of detaches
sure.
you, and I can totally get that. I wish I had the patience for more like hardcore meditation. Maybe I'll get there.
Did your rubber clown suit dissolve?
Well, yes. Well, I'm a proponent of rubber clown suit yoga, which is
right.
One of the newer schools of yoga. That's
this is different from the robot yoga, but the same place, right?
Well, yeah. Well, we get robot yoga on
yeah.
Tuesdays, and
yeah.
then rubber clown yoga is on Fridays.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I think that again, there's this idea of being eccentric, and when we talk about temporal lobe activity, like mm-hmm. we were with Van Gogh, it makes me think about the alien abduction stories that we looked into. And again, here's this case where Susan Blackmore, who is a psychologist and has really looked into this from a skeptic's point of view, visited someone named Michael Persinger. I know you guys probably heard me talk about this before, but he's the guy who has the God machine, which has magnets, which can manipulate the frontal lobe, so on and so forth. And what they found is that people have in that area a high lability or a low lability. And what that means is that some people have more electroactivity going on in the temporal lobes than other people. And those are people that have high labilities. And those people actually, they did some studies on them, and what they found is that they tend to be a little bit more creative, and also a little bit more paranoid too, which is interesting. And these are the people that tend to have these experiences of feeling like they've been abducted before.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, you got the explosions in the mind, I think is what it's boiling down to.
Yeah. Well, I remember the whole deal with William Blake, like supposedly he was, you know, visited
by
an angel as a child, and he had a lot of sort of craziness going on. He's, from what I've read about him, he seemed to be a happy guy, but he did have some pretty fantastic stuff going on in his life.
Okay, so if I don't want to use drugs or I don't want to go mad, but I want to be creative, how do I do it best?
Well, I think some of the tips are kind of out there already. Like the ones that I like are like experiencing new things and, you know, and traveling.
Yeah.
There's the whole argument that time seems to, like we experience time differently when we're on vacation because we're seeing everything new for the first time.
Yeah.
And that we experience that time seems to, speed up as we get older because we're seeing less new things.
Yeah.
When we're younger, like there's so much that's new. There's so much that's bright.
Wasn't it Einstein who said something about time slowing down when he's talking to a pretty girl?
Yeah. Yeah. He used the whole, beautiful woman, analogy to explain, relativity.
Yeah. Such a rogue.
Yeah. And he designed a spaceship that was, they would load the hull of it with 5,000 beautiful women
right.
and one male pilot. And he would look at a different beautiful woman each day and it would power the special engines. That
yeah.
Einstein
that
created.
Little known NASA, project that didn't get off the ground.
Yeah. But so that's one, you know, I think it's like new experiences. And then absorbing like creativity, you know, reading things, mm-hmm. looking at things that are creative, you know, you are what you eat kind of a situation.
Yeah.
You know, and also like as they turn off that judgment center, not being afraid to ask troubling questions about yourself.
Yeah. And thought experiments too. I thought this was interesting. Trying to mm-hmm. create a solution to a problem that you could never really like something like, how do I say it? Like, it would be an experiment that just had no solution. So
right.
how do I get my cat to make something for me for dinner that I would like to eat?
Okay. Yeah. You see, you asked this one yesterday. And so now you quantified a little more because
that's what I know because you started to answer it. And I was like, no, not a dead bird. I don't want a dead bird and I want him to serve it to me. And I want it to be seasoned with rosemary. But yeah, I mean, so the mind starts to play with like, well, so, okay, maybe I could put some treats around. I mean, and again, this is engaging your brain in all these different ways of thinking.
Yeah. Or, you know, it's like you mash up two ideas and then you're like, all right, how does that work? You know, as a story or as a piece of art or as music. It's like a random combination and then you have to make sense of it. I really like that view of things.
Yeah. And then there's collaboration too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
As long as there's not competition, because competition actually makes people squirrel away their best information and doesn't actually ever create some sort of group collective great thing.
Hmm.
So you have to not be a squirreler awayer.
No squirreling.
No.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sleep and dreaming, of course, we know.
Yeah, sleep is big. Actually sleep so your brain can function.
Right.
And can do things other than just try and keep you from tipping over from lack of balance. And like we've shown, our dreams are, it's like the mind's a defragmenter. So, let it run every now and then. Otherwise that hard drive's going to crash.
It's going to. Yeah. Hard.
Yeah.
Speaking of defragging, do we have any defragging on email here?
We do. We have some listener mail that I'm going to read here for us. Jane writes in. She says, "Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that in Japanese, kawaii, K-A-W-A-I-I, well, that's the, you know, the English version of the kanji, cute is pronounced ka, like the kaing of a crow. So ka. Ka, like the cawing of a crow. Wa is in water, and I as in the letter E. So
kawaii.
Kawaii.
Like Hawaii.
Exactly.
Okay.
Kawaii. Cute. The way you were pronouncing it made it sound like kawaii, which in Japanese means scary.
Which is the opposite of cute.
Which is the, well, but then again, like I said, there's that whole kawaii noir thing, which combines
right,
the two.
Right, so, that's right, yeah.
But anyway, just an FYI, Jane says, love the podcast. So yes, thanks for the clarification on that. We actually received a couple of comments on that from from our listeners that are more in tune with the Japanese language and or Japanese culture.
Yeah.
And we also heard from Adam. Adam wrote in and says, while listening to the podcast, I couldn't help but reflect, and he's talking about the podcast, Are You Smarter Than an Ant Swarm? He says, I couldn't help but reflect on the Middle East and the protests going on right now. Is social media creating an emergence intelligence that is shaping our world today? I hear stories of people using Twitter to avoid snipers and Facebook to organize marches in real time, and it all seems like something greater than our current understanding. There's some interesting thought.
Yeah, I was looking at an RSS feed the other day and actually saw something that was ranking pretty high, but I didn't have a whole lot of time to look. But it was something about a Facebook entry asking people to help them with the chemical properties of tear gas and how to ameliorate that, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, they're doing all sorts of interesting things. Actually, I wrote an article called Are Smartphones Worth It?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes into a little to the idea of like smartphones being annoying in, modern Western culture, but also it goes into how it was written. This was before the protest broke out, how it was helping to achieve social change in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
And indeed, just the other day, this Nigerian guy contacted me on Facebook, and I'm sending him money to help out the situation there.
Is he a deposed king?
Yes, he is.
Wow.
Did you read about this on AP? Is there a story on AP or something about
it? No, I was contacted as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's both kick in on this.
Let's talk about this later, because there's some really big things happening with that. But, you know, I don't want to share with everybody.
But if you want to share something with us, check us out on Twitter and Facebook. We are Blow the Mind on both of those, and we try to keep those updated pretty regularly with all sorts of cool happenings on How Stuff Works and elsewhere on the web.
And, hey, I was just sitting here thinking, it is not Damien Hirst, who's the artist who did the big puppy dog. It is actually Jeff Koons. Damien Hirst is the guy that likes to play with animal carcasses. entirely different. So there you go, Jeff Koons, who has the team of people helping him. So, to that end, do you guys have a team of people helping you? What sort of things get your creative juices flowing? Let us know at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was wooden!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.